All right, let's head over to the Zoom line. Mike Foss is with us. Foss with an F as in fire truck. Mike Foss, he's with Warrior Bonfire. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm fantastic.
Well, thanks for joining us here today. And I enjoyed our pre-interview talk as we were finding out that we've had some crossing of the geographical paths along the journey of our life, but we're here today to talk about the Warrior Bonfire. That's an interesting name. And before we get into actually, you know, some of the issues and some of the different advocacy that comes with what you do, I'm really curious where the name came from and how it relates to what we're going to talk about and et cetera. So give us the genesis of the name, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, and to do that, I kind of got to tell you a little bit of a story. A guy named Dan Fordyce that I started my Army career with over 40 years ago. Dan lives in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And he at one time decided him and his brother wanted to take some wounded warriors on a hunting trip, a deer hunting. They have a nice piece of deer hunting property about an hour outside of Vicksburg. And so Dan, being who Dan is calling all these big military hospitals, Walter Reed, Vamsi, Balboa, and hey, send me some wounded warriors. And they're all like, who the heck are you? Go away. Don't call us back. And Dan, he already ran had a nonprofit, and he said, well, you know, if I'm going to do this and get somebody to at least listen to me, I'm going to start a nonprofit. And obviously the word warrior it was designed to, signify that we're helping warriors. Right. And the bonfire thing, and I'll tell you more about that later, but basically Dan decided that, hey, at the end of the trip, I want to do a U.S. flag retirement ceremony. So he was talking to a guy named Chuck Williams. Chuck had been blown up in an RPG attack, rocket propelled grenade attack, died on the table. Anyways, and so Dan met him, and the guy said, first of all, you don't need to call Walter Reed. There's plenty of guys in our backyard. And he told Dan that I can get more out of hanging around the bonfire with five or six guys that had been there than I'm going to get with a counselor, spending all day with a counselor. So that's where bonfire comes from. I'll tell you more about that bonfire ceremony when we get a little bit further into things.
Warrior Bonfire. And what is the services, I guess, that the nonprofit provides, or kind of the about us, if you will, on the website, something along those lines? What's kind of an overview of the company today?
Well, what we do is we serve Purple Heart recipients, those combat wounded veterans that were injured through enemy contact. Okay, lots of guys get injured, but this is, injuries through enemy contact. So we take groups of six on what we call bonfire retreats around the country. And the whole idea of it is, one, to get them in the great outdoors. There's healing in the great outdoors. It's called recreational therapy. And if anybody doesn't know that there's, that's true therapy, all I'll tell them is, hey, have you ever had a crappy day in the office and you went outside and you went for a walk around the parking lot and you came back in and you felt a little bit better? That's recreational therapy. So we take them on retreats around the country with all sorts of different activities: hunting, fishing, skiing, snowmobiling, golfing, horseback riding, fish, boating, NASCAR experiences, you name surfing, you name it, we've done it. And if we haven't, we'll probably be doing it soon. So we bring them together for that. But it truly is therapeutic to be in the outdoors. But the other idea is, you know, if we come and say, hey, you're going to be on this therapeutic retreat, no one's going to sign up. So it's an opportunity to sign up for something you want to do or have never done before. And there's what we're really trying to do on each bonfire trip is foster healing. And I'll talk about what that means in a second. Building support communities, again, I'll talk about it, and improving and saving lives. And how do you do those things? I've come to the realization over you know, the last, how long have I been doing this? 10 years, that people that have post-traumatic stress need to be able to tell their story to people that have been through the same things that they have or similar things that they have. And I'm going to give you three examples. And the first two really have nothing to do with the warrior bonfire. They don't have anything to do with veterans. A woman that goes through childbirth. That's a traumatic event. Now, it's a happy traumatic event, but it's a traumatic event. And a woman that goes through childbirth can only really talk about it with another woman that's been through childbirth. And you know, I was in the room three times. I still don't totally get everything my wife went through to have those three kids. And then the other example I'll use is when my youngest son was 18 years old, a senior in high school. There was a shooting at his school. Kyle heard the gunfire, heard the Molotov cocktails going off, knew the girl that was murdered, knew the murderer who took his own life, and knew the teacher that was really the target, teacher slash coach that was really the target. To this day, and this happened in December of 2013, Kyle has not talked about that day to me, to his mom, to his big brother, to his big sister. Who'd he talk to? Classmates, teachers, coaches, people that were in the building, because they went through that. Yes, as a parent, it was traumatic for us, but the kid didn't do it. And then the third example I'm going to give you is a guy named Philip Cascio. Philip was World War II veteran. He died a few years ago, just shy of his 100th birthday. And Philip had been in a B-17 bomber going over the English Channel. They got shot down, but they were able to land in the water. They got lifeboats out and got in those, but they were captured by the Nazis. And he spent 811 days in a German POW camp. And he told Dan, at 97 years old, he told Dan, our founder, that throughout his life, he would get nightmares, what we call PTSD. And when those nightmares would come, he would call up one of his buddies that had been in the POW camp with him, talk it through, and he said the nightmares would go away. And then he said, now all those guys are gone. He was 97 at the time. All those guys are gone. I got nightmares every daily. So we're helping them by building that greater support community. So when their nightmares come, they have someone to talk to. And that fosters their healing, and improves their lives. We do three formal things on a bonfire retreat, and formal is by far a crappy word, but I just can't think of another one. The first thing is night number one. After everybody settled in, had a good meal, everybody tells their story. I have not been on one of those retreats, and I've probably been on 50 or 60 of them, where suicide didn't come up. either contemplating suicide, attempting and failing to commit suicide, but it always comes up. And they truly open up. Now, sometimes it takes a little while for them to open up. I had a guy at a ranch in South Dakota. Night one, he couldn't, he just said, I can't, I can't. And 2 or 3 days later, I can't remember, we're making lunch. And he comes out, and the guy's name was Doug, and Doug comes out and says, all right, I'm ready to tell my story. So everybody stops, we all sit down, and he tells his story. So there's the storytelling part, telling your story to people that have experienced similar things, is post-traumatic stress healing and growth. The other thing we do is we do what we call a coping session, but it's really for the guys to sit around and how do they cope with things? How do they cope with the VA? How do they cope with anger? How do they cope with post-traumatic stress? Excuse me, traumatic brain injury. How do they cope with kids? How do they cope with spouses, jobs, whatever? This conversation can go, I've seen it an hour, seen it 3 hours. But the idea is for people to pick up ways of coping with things from each other. I heard one on the very first time I did this. Guy's name was Art, and he said he just gets extremely mad and frustrated at things and at people. And what he started doing was when he'd see that anger coming up, he would say the Lord's Prayer. And he said, and that started to work, help me. And he goes, now, sometimes I say it once and it's good. Sometimes I have to say it 10 times before I kind of calm down. But that's what that coping session is all about, teaching and sharing. And then our bonfire ceremony. On the last night, we do a bonfire ceremony. Now, I mentioned earlier that we do a flag retirement ceremony. And this is how we do it. First of all, we use an old Boy Scout ceremony. Dan was always in Boy Scouts. His son was in Boy Scouts, and Dan was always a leader. And so we use an old Boy Scout ceremony. But rather than retiring the flag whole, we prepare it by cutting it into stripes. Everybody gets a red, a white, and a blue stripe. And they retire each one in honor of a fallen comrade. Now, there's two things with that when you're honoring those fallen comrades that happens. One is a lot of folks have survivor's guilt. And I can tell you stories about that, but I won't get into that. But they had a buddy that they lost, and they feel it should have been them. So they have that survivor's guilt. So that retiring of the stripe, telling the story about that guy, kicks into their head that they still got to keep on going because they survived. So they got to keep on going and they got to honor him. And then the other thing, and we didn't think of this at the beginning, is a lot of the guys we got, they got blown up, they got medevaced out. And they lost a buddy in that, and they never gave him up. He never had an opportunity to say goodbye. This gives him an opportunity to say goodbye. And that's the main thing the Warrior Bonfire does. But just to add to it, we do two other things. We do what we call spouses retreats, because a lot of the spouses, they might not have post-traumatic stress, but they're living with post-traumatic stress. And they don't have anybody to talk to. So we follow the same program. The activities are a little different, but we follow the same program. Everything's the same, but it's for the spouses. And then the divorce rate's high in our country anyways, but in the military, it's even higher. And then you take combat guys, it's even higher. And the combat wounded guys, it's about a 90% divorce rate. So we're doing couples trips, again, following the same program, but doing different activities designed to help these guys improve their marriages. And I say these guys, it's there's women Purple Heart, women Purple Hearts too, so it's everything. But that's pretty much the Warrior Bonfire.
What's the number one issue that you're facing with
Post-traumatic
this
stress.
post-traumatic stress? And what seems to be the biggest issue there? Awareness, funding, education?
Well, when we talk about the guys that we're serving, it's everything I just told you. Us as an organization, the way I like to describe it is the hard work for us. Yeah, it's fundraising, planning trips, airline reservations. Airlines are very expensive. All the logistical stuff. Fundraising, all that. That's our hard part. But the important work is done by the Purple Hearts themselves. And each bonfire trip, retreat, costs around $15,000. Now, we work very hard to get in-kind donations. So, somebody lets us use their house. Somebody provides a meal. Somebody we get a discount on an activity. For example, when we do our Battle Lake trip, I can't remember the name of the ranch off the top of my head. But anyways, she discounts the horseback riding that we do. My one cousin, takes the guy out fishing. I got another cousin that takes him out on jet skis and then does a pontoon boat ride. Those in-kind donations help defer that $15,000 cost.
One of the things I've noticed through my career, I guess would be the way to put it, but my path and my career was about 15 years ago. Excuse me. About 15 years ago, I got pretty deep in through my reporting and nonprofit boards and a number of different things, with the homeless population. And the one thing that was very prevalent were veterans that were homeless for a variety of reasons, for a variety of reasons. And then during a certain recession, in order to further my different revenue streams, I had reached out to the healthcare industry, the drone UAS industry, and actually the cannabis industry. And the cannabis industry is the one that gave me an opportunity to do some writing for a variety of different magazines. And I spent some time in Colorado, actually, with the first dispensary in the United States, the first medicinal one, and the first one that was allowed to use some SEC currency type stuff. So a lot of the high level type of different things. But what I learned there was there was a high percentage of veterans that were using it as a form of medicine. Now, when I took a look at the oil and gas industry, when I was there for like 3 to 5 years, pretty heavy, there was a very high veteran population there as well. One of the things that was prevalent through the whole thing, though, was there was this underfunding of whether it be from the veterans hospitals to the opioid versus different alternative medicines to, like I say, the homeless population that had so many veterans. The way we talk about America First and the way we talk about these different funding mechanisms in place to be fail safes as veterans. What are you finding that is the biggest takeaway from what you're doing that really should be patchworked quicker along that supply chain, if that makes sense? I don't know if I'm making sense to you or not, but it just seems like there's a lot of fail safes in place that are failing, and they need advice from people like you to say, okay, there's some real mental health successes with the great outdoors. And actually there's a lot of scientific evidence as well. That's the one that really stands out in my mind, is I think you called it recreational therapy. That's the first time I've heard that word. What are some of the other kind of oddities or idiosyncrasies or just kind of observational, you know, anecdotal things that you think maybe should be implemented somewhere along the supply chain of mental health and medicine somewhere quicker for veterans?
Well, first of all, mental health is an issue in this country, regardless whether you're veterans or not, you know, and ultimately, our biggest thing is saving lives through what we do. The suicide rate amongst our youth and our veterans is extremely, extremely high. And when you look at the three causes of death for men under 50 in the United States, number one is heart issues, heart attacks, you know, cardiac arrest, all that kind of stuff. Number two is automobile accidents. And number three is suicide. We talk a lot about heart attacks. Okay, we do a lot. We're trying to always take care of that heart, right? We put a lot of money into research and medicine and all that kind of stuff. The number two, you know, I get in my car and it's beeping at me and flashing at me, and it tells me if I'm going across the lane without my turn signal on. We do all sorts of things to make cars safe, right? Okay. We don't talk about suicide. As a people, as a government, we don't talk about suicide. And when you look at it, the majority being our youth and our veterans, well, first of all, a lot of those veterans were part of our youth when they took their lives. And it goes on. So it's, to me, programs like ours, are getting down to the meat and potatoes. What we do is fairly simplistic. Take guys, you know, to a week at the lake. And they do activities together. They share their stories. They advise each other. They bond, and that bond continues. And so when you take organizations like ours, now I'm going to tell you something. There is over 7,500. I think it's over 8,000 now. Purple Heart recipients from post 9/11, from the global war on terror. And I don't know what the number now is for Vietnam, but 10 years ago, it was 50,000 Vietnam veterans. We've served about 500. So there's a heck of a lot more for us to serve. But it comes down to funding. Trying to get that funding is a full-time job. Now, with a staff of three or two and a half, I guess, with two full-time, one part-time, there's only so much that we can do because we got to do everything, right? Running a nonprofit's running a business. So you can't just focus, you got to focus on your programs and then try to fundraise around that.
Well, I think the nonprofit sector is more competitive than the private sector these days.
I would not use the word competitive because we don't compete with other nonprofits. Now the big guys, maybe they think of it as competition. I don't know the big guys.
You might not use the word competitive, but other
Yeah,
people might. I mean,
but we go out.
I've heard government people say we're competing for market share out there. So, I mean,
Could
it.
be, but the way we look at that, we collaborate very, very quite often with other organizations that are doing similar but not the same things.
Well, and that's really where I was going to go with my next question to you is I look at another one of the solutions to, kind of helping out the different links along the supply chain of mental health, the different supply chains of communication, is the sharing of stories, is the allowing somebody to have their voice be heard.
Yep.
And that was the other theme that through my course of my history of the different industries I've covered where the homeless population seemed to really spike up, that was the other thing that they would talk about often is, they just almost wish that somebody would just believe them one time or listen to them one time because what they've done is so extraordinary. It's hard for the average person to connect. It's hard for them to have empathy or even sympathy because they can't even imagine a world that a soldier's been through and hear the soldiers trying to explain it to them. And I think you mentioned that earlier, how there was kind of, people who had a similar experience, they would get together almost as a support group because they would be able to understand the context of the conversation. To me, that's the other takeaway that I took from what you're offering with the with the bonfire with the Warrior Bonfire as far as for these Purple Heart recipients out there. What's your thoughts on that as far as the the conversational aspect of it and the sharing the story?
I'm sorry. I kind of lost it. Say the last question again.
Oh, about your thoughts about the sharing of the stories and being able to, have their voice be heard. How impactful and prominent do you think that is as part of your warrior bonfire, the weekend retreats and that sort of thing?
Well, it's impactful because they've been through the same thing. So there's a bond amongst veterans that that automatically kicks in. And then you take these guys that were combat wounded and that bond is even greater. So when they tell their story, they're telling their story to somebody that completely understands what they're saying. And then they advise each other on different ways of dealing with things. And that's the power of it, is that you're telling your story to someone that has lived your story. Maybe not exactly, but almost the same, almost exactly. And that's what's the power behind it. Does that
How many of these
answer?
do you do, by the way?
How many do we do?
Yeah.
This year we will be at, by the end of the year, we'll be at 33 for the year.
And how many states?
We have been in just this year or overall? I'd have to,
Overall. Yeah, overall. Yeah.
overall, we've been in 33 states plus Puerto Rico.
Okay. And just kind of walk us through the real bullet point itinerary type things of what somebody would expect or somebody who went through one of these bonfires, Warrior Bonfire. Now these are Purple Heart recipients, correct?
Right.
And yeah, what does a weekend look like?
They're all a little different. But I'll tell you this, we got a group flying into Pierre, South Dakota today. And they're gonna they're all getting in there sometime today. I don't have the flight stuff with me. So tonight they'll get in there. They'll have the people at the ranch will have a big dinner for them prepped, and then they'll go into their storytelling tonight. Tomorrow and Saturday they will do pheasant hunting on the ranch, and then on Sunday they'll do some fun stuff. Typically they'll go out and they'll ride some ATVs along the ranch. There's a couple fishing holes that they'll go fishing in. And sometime during Sunday afternoon, they'll have that coping session. And then Sunday night, they will have a nice dinner, and then they'll go have their bonfire, and do the bonfire ceremony. And then the next morning, Monday morning, I think I got my days right. Yeah, Monday morning, they'll get in the car, and some of them will fly. There's a that we've got some commercial pilots that volunteer to fly for us. So there's a couple that are going to be picked up at the airport and pier on private planes, and then the rest of them will drive to Sioux Falls and get on a commercial flight. And that's a typical weekend.
How do people be a part of this if they're a Purple Heart recipient or if they know someone? Do you reach out to them? Do they reach out to you? How does that whole process work?
Almost all those, not all, but up until a year ago, almost everybody was recommended by another Purple Heart. And then they we had the VA do an article on us, so we got a big influx of folks. And then we got the Wounded Warrior Project do an article about us, a podcast, I think. And then we got another 100. So we've got mostly by word of mouth amongst Purple Hearts. But then we got a cut, the VA Wounded Warrior Project have vetted us and think what we're doing is working. And so they've put it out there. Now there's a downfall to that. We got 200 guys that are on our wait list that we can, we're slowly not getting them on bonfire retreats. With the, to get the funding to serve them all is going to take about $300,000. So we're working on that.
And how do people support you if they want to sponsor? Is there individual donations? I'm sure there's corporate donations.
Yeah, actually, there's individual donations, recurring do individual recurring donations, corporate donations, grants that we receive. We get a lot of our funds through, fundraising events, and so it comes from a variety of things. If folks are interested in supporting us, you can get on our website at warriorbonfireprogram.org, and it'll give you information how to make a donation right there, or you can look at our address. We got a few couple addresses in there where they can mail in a check. If they want to volunteer, they can. There's a volunteer where they can, fill out a form, and it'll come to us, and we'll get in touch with them and see what it is they can and want to do. So there's a variety of ways to get there, but it's all on our website, warriorbonfireprogram.org.
And what's the main takeaway you want people to take away, I guess, from Warrior Bonfire? What's the main takeaway?
that we're all these folks that we're serving, almost all of them at one time or another, self-medicated on alcohol or drugs. Most of them did not become addicts, but a lot of them did. And that their injuries, their physical injuries, go through their life, but most importantly, the mental injuries that they've had go through their life. And we think that we all owe them our time and our treasure, because they were wounded in their service to us all. They volunteered and they went and served. And through that, I think we for our lives, we owe them whatever we can do to make their lives easier and make their wounds, especially their mental wounds. They're not going to go away, but they can see growth and healing in what we as Americans can do for them.
Mike Foss is the president of Warrior Bonfire. Appreciate the time. And what was the website one more time?
WarriorBonfireProgram.org.